they'd like to ask during the presentation, go ahead and ask them. He'll present for about 35 minutes, and then we'll go into member questions and discussion. Mr. Zindler, thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks very much, and hi, everybody. And first, I just want to say thanks so much to everyone for hosting me here today, in particular to the Madam Chair and the Chairman, as well as the other organizations who are kind enough to invite me. I got a lot of slides, a lot of charts, and hopefully I'll keep it interesting. Chat for about, I guess, about 35 minutes or so, and then welcome your questions. My role here today is really to talk about the state of the global solar market. I don't pretend to be an expert on the Minnesota energy scene. We very much view this from a global perspective. So let me quickly just about who we are. So Bloomberg New Energy Finance is a market research firm focused explicitly on the clean energy sectors, wind, solar, biofuels, geothermal, as well as what we call energy smart technologies, such as electric vehicles and other forms of energy efficiency. We were founded in London 8 years ago, and then we were bought by Bloomberg LP. And so essentially, we are a market research firm that's part of Bloomberg overall. Our clients primarily began as the major investors in the sector, investment banks and hedge funds and project finance groups. Then increasingly became manufacturing firms, those who make solar panels, those who make wind turbines and others. And increasingly now are government agencies, governments around the world who are trying to make smart decisions about policies in clean energy. This includes governments in the UK, Australia, Japan, and here in the US, US Department of Energy, US Department of Commerce, the State Department, the Pentagon, and others. All subscribe to our research, and we try to advise them on making smart decisions about how either to make money investing in clean energy or how to craft smart policies that are cost effective and make wise use of taxpayer or ratepayer dollars. So with that introduction out of the way, and one last point I guess I would say is I'm an analyst. I'm not here as an advocate on policy, and I hope to give honest answers in terms of the way we see the market functioning today. I'm not here to advocate for or against any particular piece of legislation, but merely to comment for you on where the overall solar industry is today. So with that out of the way, here are the three main areas I'm going to talk about. One, I'm going to give a quick bit of context in terms of the amount of money that's been invested in clean energy globally over the last decade or so. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about specifically global solar trends. And then finally, I'm going to talk about U.S. Specific solar trends. So in terms of total investment in clean energy, and I think it's important to be clear about what we define here as clean energy. In this context, I'm talking about renewables, which is wind, solar, geothermal and biomass in particular, and small hydro, not large hydro projects. I don't think that's me, but I'll turn off my phone just in case. And biofuels as well. And basically what this chart shows is that we've tracked well over $1 trillion in almost entirely private capital that's gone into clean energy over the last decade or so. And as I mentioned earlier, most of this money is being invested for those who want to earn a healthy return on their investment, those in the private sector. What you can see if you look a little bit carefully, and it may be a challenge for some folks here, is that basically we went from about $50 billion invested in the industry globally in 2004 all the way up to about $190 billion in 2008, at which point the global financial crisis and Great Recession took hold, with essentially a leveling out of investment, and then things kicked back into gear actually in 2010 and 11, in large part because a lot of governments around the world put up a lot of stimulus money specifically to help clean energy. And the all-time high for investment we've seen in a year was over $300 billion in 2011. That actually declined from 2011 to 2012 to $269 billion, an 11% drop. And the reasons for that, in some ways, are bad and good. On the one hand, there's been a little less money invested, a little less interest, of course. But on the other hand, a big part of the reason for the dollar volume declining is that the cost of clean energy has been dropping very substantially. So in other words, you're getting more bang for your buck when you invest in clean energy now than you did even a couple of years ago. So from 2011 to 2012, globally, about the same amount of new clean energy capacity was installed in each year, but it just cost a lot less money to do it. In terms of where the investment's going, just very quickly, I think one of the interesting sidebars here to the sort of global picture is that traditionally it had been Europe that had been leading the way. But increasingly, we're starting to see some developing world nations really take an interest in investment in this area. Without getting into this in detail, I'll just say that the OECD countries here, which are the developing world countries and, the developed world countries, accounted for about 57% of investment last year, which was down substantially from what was 84% in 2004. And the basic countries, like Brazil, South Africa, India, and China, taking up a bigger percentage of the overall investment in the rest of the world, which is the much smaller countries as well, are also growing in terms of investment. So we're seeing a greater diversification in terms of where the money is flowing to the industry. Now, finally, about talking a little bit about the technologies themselves. Solar, as I mentioned, the overall amount of money that flowed into the industry declined year on year from 2011 to 2012. The solar industry, however, accounted for the largest overall chunk of the pie in terms of new money that went in at about $138 billion in total. That was a 9% decline, but it's certainly striking given that just 3 or 4 years ago, the wind industry was the largest subsector of clean energy. And as all of you know, in this region, you've seen these enormous projects being built. But solar has really taken off in the last couple of years in terms of the amount of capacity that's been added, and I'll get into that in just a moment. All right, so turning to the actual specifics of the global solar market. Here are the basics, and I'll get into more details on these in the charts to come, but these are sort of the dynamics defining the solar sector at the moment. First, there's a massive imbalance between the amount of demand there is in the world right now for new solar systems and the amount of capacity there is in the world to produce solar panels. There's simply about twice as much capacity available around the world as there is demand, and that has serious implications, as you might imagine, for pricing, which is my second point, which is plummeting equipment prices we've seen over the last several years due to both technology advancements, but also because of this supply-demand imbalance. And now we're starting to see a real growth in demand coming from newer countries. The EU had been the leader, particularly Germany, but also Italy. But post-Fukushima, Japan is coming on very strong as a demand for solar. The Japanese government has essentially pledged not to turn most of their their nuclear reactors back on. That's created a major gap in demand, and so solar demand has been growing very quickly there. But China is also a market that we expect to be very big this year. The next point is that solar equipment has become commoditized, meaning that basically consumers, for the most part, are not terribly discriminating about the quality of the panel that they buy. They buy the cheapest one that they can because most of the ones that are in the market are good enough. In other words, it's hard to say that there's a Cadillac of solar or a VW Bug of solar. People just want to get the cheapest solar they can, that has largely been driven by China, and I'll talk a lot more about China in a moment. And then almost finally, we're starting to see a great deal of consolidation and some bankruptcies and some what we just call downright value destruction taking place in the industry. When you have way more capacity available than there is demand, inevitably somebody has to stop producing and stop making money, and that's happening. And inevitably we're seeing a number of major bankruptcies take place. And by the way, there is a narrative, I've flown here from Washington, and the narrative we often hear is, oh, the Chinese are the ones who are controlling the whole market, and the U.S. firms are having their lunches eaten. That is too simplistic an explanation. We saw one of the largest Chinese manufacturers, one of the traditionally best respected ones, the first one to list on the New York Stock Exchange, a company called Suntech, has essentially gone bankrupt. Big Chinese player. So it's not just U.S. companies that are feeling the pinch from this oversupply. And then finally, there's an interesting development in the last several years, which has been an outbreak of trade skirmishes, some might even call trade wars, in terms of the way in which solar panels can cross international borders, with increasingly tariffs being applied. The U.S. has put in place tariffs on Chinese-assembled solar modules. The Chinese are threatening to put in place tariffs on U.S.-produced polysilicon. The U.S. has complained that India is not letting U.S.-made equipment into India. The EU is making complaints about China. There are a lot of trade complaints going on, some tariffs putting in place, and this actually all has the potential to artificially drive up the cost of solar for the end consumer. So I'm going to elaborate on a bunch of those. Those are basically the basic points, and you can probably all check the Blackberries now or go home or wherever. I'm just going to get into more detail at this point, but this is just a quick look at, in short, that overcapacity situation I was talking about. That red line along the top that you see there is the current cell manufacturing capacity. So that's the amount of cells. Solar cells are the cells that go into the solar panel. You assemble the panel. Then you sell them to someone, they put them up on the roof. The cells are fairly sophisticated things to manufacture, but can be done at very large scale. And there's roughly just under 60 gigawatts of capacity per year. That means that if everybody was producing cells at their maximum 100% capacity utilization all year long, you'd have about 60 gigawatts produced. Just to put that in context, last year there was about 32 gigawatts of actual solar deployed out into the world, so about half of that. And the point of this chart is just to show, without going into great detail, and I'm happy to answer questions, but the point of this chart is just to show that we've plotted two scenarios, lines, in terms of demand, of where things are going. One's more optimistic than the other, but in both cases, there's just simply a lot more capacity out there right now than there will be demand over the next several years. And that's creating some of the issues that we're seeing in our industry. In terms of where the demand, though, is coming from, I thought it was important just to look at internationally who's doing what. The green chunks that you see here, and I know some are looking from afar, this maps year by year the number of gigawatts that have been installed globally. And you can see the dark green chunks at the bottom are Western Europe. 2010, 2011, 2012, but particularly 2011, we saw a tremendous amount of demand, and particularly from Germany, which in 1 year has put in about 7.5 gigawatts or 7,500 megawatts of capacity. And in 1 year, Italy put in about 8,000 megawatts of capacity. By comparison, the U.S. had its best year ever last year and installed 3,200 megawatts of capacity. And obviously, we are a much larger country than each of those and have much, much larger appetites for electricity. So you've seen real booms that have taken place in Western Europe. However, that is rapidly declining, in large part because subsidies are being reduced in those countries. And demand is shifting very rapidly to Japan, which is the orange chunk you can see there, and to China. Japan, as I mentioned earlier, is dealing with making up for a loss of capacity post-Fukushima. And the China situation is really interesting. I'll talk a little bit more about it. But China is by far and away the number one manufacturer of solar cells and modules, but very, very little capacity of actual systems have gone on the roofs in China. So in other words, they built this giant manufacturing industry with this idea of exporting it to the rest of us. But at the same time, they were building giant coal plants, about 1 gigawatt or one major new coal plant per week for the last several years to meet their own local energy needs. So the view was, we'll export the solar, but we'll do the coal locally. Well, we're reaching an interesting point now where China itself is now going to be a major demand market for solar for a number of reasons that I'll get into in just a moment. So again, just to put this in context, in terms of level of penetration or use of solar in different countries around the world, this is just a look at the different levels of GDP per country, which is the axis along the bottom. And then the number of actual watts installed per person, which is the actual on the left-hand side. And basically, you know, as you see in the far right-hand corner, that little bubble, that's the USA. That's, you know, we were it's not the richest country on Earth, close to it, right? And then if you look, and as you move right to left, you can see other countries by the size of their bubbles indicating the level of capacity. And you can see Germany, a country whose GDP is not much smaller than the United States, but has a substantially much higher level of penetration in terms of solar on a per capita basis. The U.S. is much smaller market traditionally than these others.
We have a quick question for you, a clarifying question. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question was, on the previous slide, you had mentioned that China had been bringing on one major coal plant per week, and that's changed. I was just curious, how much production were in the four or five coal facilities that Germany brought on just recently?
How much production in those
generation?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I mean, typically, you know, a coal plant could be as big as about a gigawatt, so it could be 4 to 5 as well. The German situation is a very interesting one, and that they've added a tremendous amount of solar capacity, and it's come on so rapidly and so dramatically that it's actually starting to take some market share from the utilities. And so the utilities themselves, in some cases, are more apt to burn coal now because that's a cheap opportunity for them. It's a very different energy situation over there. Over here, natural gas has become incredibly cheap, and a lot of U.S. utilities are pursuing it. Over there, coal is often the cheaper opportunity, and so the utilities are burning more coal, in part because to make up some of the gap of the lost profits that they've suffered due to the growth of solar in Germany. So, but this has a cost, these kinds of subsidies, and that's my next slide. And this, I apologize, is only as of the end of 2011, so clearly things have changed since then. But this is just a look at the annual cost as a share of GDP of these subsidies. In Germany, they have a national feed-in tariff that they use. Which essentially they pay a fixed rate for solar generated power, and that essentially incurs a public liability. And you can see that Germany, and in particular Italy, as a percentage overall of GDP, those costs are very high. Czech Republic, I find very interesting, a relatively small country that very quickly had a big solar boom and incurred a substantial cost in terms of paying for that. I put this slide in here not really to give any sort of specific policy prescription other than to say that when you craft a solar policy, I think it's important to make sure that you do so in a way that takes into account the long-term implications and costs. And I will venture to say that I don't think that was necessarily done very carefully in some of these countries, and the costs are going to be fairly substantial over the long term. However, they created their subsidies at a time when solar was much more expensive, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. So the potential cost for other policymakers in other countries now can and should be much less. And this is one of the reasons why. So if you look here, just jump ahead on my own slides here to catch up. This is the one of the things that our firm does is we sample, we survey about 300 folks in the market who are either producing or installing solar equipment, and we ask them how much they're paying for it. And they give us the information on an anonymous basis, and we publish it every month. And the idea is to try and bring some transparency to a market that essentially is fairly opaque to begin with. So over the course of a four-year period from 2008 to 2012, the price of a silicon module, that's a sort of a typical bog standard module that you might put up on your roof, dropped by 75% as a result of a few factors that I talked about earlier and more that I'll talk about in a moment. If you look even more recently, this is a sort of a closer lens over the last 18 months or so, the price has continued to go down. So we're basically somewhere in the range of about 80% down in the last, since the start of 2008. this has been, I mean, frankly, a monumental decline in costs, and it has serious implications, I think, for the market, but also for policymakers in terms of thinking about how much you want to actually spend on subsidizing solar. It's not as expensive as it used to be. So in theory, subsidies shouldn't have to be as generous as they were several years ago. If we look a little bit more closely, these are the chunks of the value chain for the manufacture of a solar panel. So without getting into too great detail, first thing you do when you make a solar panel is you need to process silicon. Basically, you know, it's more or less sand. You have to highly, highly refine it. Then you create a long, what's called ingot, and then you slice that up, and eventually you get what are called cells. And then you take those very, very thin cells, and you put them basically under glass, and you create a module. So this is just a look at the price of each one of these chunks. Those of you who can see may notice that there's a box that says in the bottom right that says best in class margin per watt. That's a blue box. In other words, what would an operator, let's say, of a module plant, what would the profit be on the best in class module that they might produce? And then please take a look, and you'll notice that in each one of these chunks, but let's start with modules, you see minus 0.07 for cells, you see minus 0.03 for ingots and wafers, it's minus 0.08. In other words, everybody's losing money right now who's producing in the value chain for solar. There's just, you know, and you one could look at this from a business perspective and say, how is this possible? Who produces and loses money? And it's not possible. So, you know, the reality of it is that what we're seeing is consolidation, some bankruptcies, and inevitably these prices have to rise just enough in order for these different players to actually make a little bit of money. But our view is that we don't think prices are going to go anywhere near where they were 3 or 4 years ago. They're going to go up 5 or 10 cents a watt. They're not going to go up a buck or two a watt. There's a little upward movement. But the short answer right now is almost nobody in the manufacturing game is really making any money strictly manufacturing the equipment. So in terms of costs, again, now what I'm doing, shift gears just a little bit and talk not about just the modules, which is, again, the equipment, but the total price that somebody has to pay to put a system either, let's say, out into the field in the desert someplace, or the cost of putting it up on your roof. So what this chart is a look at what we call the CapEx, or capital expenditure, the all-in cost of building a system out in a field somewhere, sort of the best-in-class system you could build. So 2010, it would cost about $3.24 a watt, or $3.24 million per megawatt to put a system out. That dropped to $2.65 in 2011, and is down as low as $1.59 in 2012. So really, about a 50% drop just over 2 years in the system cost. Again, this is not talking about, we're not talking about the panels only. We're talking about the final price of actually building this stuff. And again, this has had a titanic sort of impact on the market. Looking ahead, and we do projections out through 2020, we project that the costs will continue to decline and get us close to a dollar a watt, probably about a dollar, $19, $20 a watt by 2020. One sort of interesting point, though, I'd like to make, or hopefully interesting point you guys tell me, is that the majority of the cost of a system just a several years ago used to be the equipment, the actual solar module. If you look to 2010, $1.85 of that $3.24 was from the module. Very quickly, that's flipped. So 2012, 73 cents of the $1.59 was from the module. So in other words, the majority of the cost of putting a system out into the field no longer has to do with the solar module, but has to do with the other stuff. And other stuff can include the inverter, which is another piece of equipment, but a lot of it has to do with the engineering, procurement, and contracting, the EPC that's involved, and other costs involving filing for permits, dealing with the lawyers, all the other kinds of things that go on when it comes to actually building a project. And I guess I point this out only to say that The challenge of driving down the cost of solar over the next, you know, 8-10 years, a large part of it actually does not have to do with technology, but has to do with just getting smarter about putting these systems out into the field. And so I have some optimism that that can take place, and I'll tell you why in just a moment. This is just same breakdown for those who are interested on the cost of a residential system, so the system that goes up on a home roof. The costs are obviously higher for residential because you're not doing it in bulk. You don't enjoy the volumes of scale that you do when you put, like, say, hundreds of panels out into the field. So one of the reasons I'm somewhat optimistic that the U.S. in particular can drive down its costs is because, frankly, we do solar a lot more expensively in the United States than they do in Germany. And they're buying the same Chinese panels, the same Korean panels, in some cases U.S. panels, that we are. But they're installing the systems for a lot less money. So this is just a look at the comparative costs of a residential system, or we call a small system, in Japan, Germany, and California. And the bottom purple line is the cost of just a module. So that's not a system. That's just buying a Chinese, you know, solar panel. And what you can see is that for Germany, they've got their costs down, you know, for installing a small system to somewhere over just over $2 per watt. But if you look up, you can see that the U.S. cost for California, which I'm using as a proxy, and by the way, California represents about a third of the U.S. market for solar overall. You can see that the cost is closer to about $5.50, and Japan, you're looking at closer to about $6. And the point being that there's a major gap right now between the countries, and that to me spells opportunity for those in the U.S. who can find ways to do this cheaper. Okay, so earlier I mentioned that the China story, and I'll go back to China a little bit more now because I think it is so critically important to all of this. Earlier I mentioned that the world's capacity for manufacturing had really exploded for solar cells and modules over the last several years. And this kind of tells the story, I think, fairly simply, that the bottom red chunk is China. And you can see China had about 5 gigawatts of solar cell manufacturing capacity in 2008. And as of the end of 2012, they had 42 gigawatts of capacity. Well, you know, just about two-thirds of the global market accounted for in mainland China. And again, what this was China, Chinese companies, and in some cases Chinese government leaders, I think, too, sensed a major opportunity for growth in this industry and exports to Western Europe and to the United States, I should note, and began investing and building out capacity in a huge way over there. And as I mentioned earlier, this was not just Chinese money. A lot of this money was raised over the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. I mean, you can look these companies up right now, companies like Jinko Solar, Solar Fund, SunTech, others. They raised a lot from Western investors as well to fuel this build-out that we've seen. The same story, I'll move quickly through a few of these. It's sort of the same story for actual modules. China, again, major player. Again, this is just on a percentage basis, about 68% of cells from China. I would stop for just a second and mention that polysilicon, which is the raw ingredient that, again, is the basis for most solar panels, the U.S. has continued to have a sizable role, accounting for about 21% of the polysilicon produced and used in solar panels or modules in 2012. China, though, has been growing its chunk, although it's struggled a little bit. And one of the interesting questions, as I mentioned earlier, is whether or not the Chinese are going to impose tariffs on U.S.-made polysilicon, because the U.S. plays a very important role of exporting our silicon over to China that then goes into modules that in many cases get exported to Germany or to Japan or to the United States. And so this is one of the open questions. Inverters, the market is still much more diversified, with the United States and Germany having big roles. All right, so in terms of costs, and I know that this is always a big question, and And I'll sort of confess right away that I can't tell you exactly what the price in Minnesota should be for solar at a given moment. But one of the things that our firm does do is we do a survey every quarter, and we try and look at where these various technologies stack up in terms of their cost. So it's a little bit of a complex chart, but I'll just try and walk you through it, which is that what we do is called a levelized cost of energy analysis. And we basically say, okay, if you owned a wind project and you wanted to earn a 10% rate of return on your investment, how much would you have to sell your electricity for? That's basically our definition. Others use different definitions, but that's ours. We use 10% as a hurdle rate. Others could use different rates. We thought that was a reasonable rate. So we said, if you own that project, then you financed it in the typical way that a wind project operates, and you had typical kind of winds that we see, you know, in projects around the world, how much would you have to sell your electricity for you to earn that 10% return on your investment? And we do that for all the different technologies every quarter. And one of the important reasons we think we like to do this is because I think it's important to understand where renewables face up, in particular against coal, and in particular in the United States against natural gas. And you can see if you look towards the bottom of this chart in terms of the different technologies, we've got gas plotted out at the bottom in about roughly $50 to $125 per megawatt hour range. And then if you look up, you can see wind for onshore in the range of $50 to $125 as well. The current midpoint, and it really is just a midpoint in terms of the kinds of sample that we collect, is indicated by the triangle. Obviously, the goal for, you know, non-CO2 emitting energy sources is to move their bars from right to left and to be consistently more cost competitive or cheaper than coal and gas. And one thing I point out about this chart lastly is just this does not take into account any subsidies. So in other words, the wind prices you're seeing don't take into account the federal production tax credit or any revenue you might generate by selling renewable energy credits or anything like that. This is purely unsubsidized. And I guess one of the, you know, key things that I think is important to note is that we're starting to see wind actually become legitimately competitive with natural gas in some cases on an unsubsidized basis. There's certainly challenges from gas. I'll talk a little bit more about that in the U.S. context in a moment. But wind prices are really down, and solar prices are really down.
What does CSP stand for?
Oh, sorry. So CSP is concentrated solar power. This I've been talking about photovoltaics. CSP are these, there's different technologies, but basically it's the concept of taking a bunch of mirrors out in the field, pointing them up at a giant cauldron of liquid, boiling that, turning a turbine, generating electricity. All right, so let me talk just a few minutes about the U.S. market, and then I'll finish up here. So, one moment. So the U.S. picture has been an interesting one over the last several years. This is just a look at total dollars invested in clean energy in the United States over those years. And again, this includes renewables, it includes biofuels. It does not include large hydro, it doesn't include nuclear, and it does not include natural gas. And it doesn't include coal. And what you can see is that the U.S. market has been a very important one. Again, let's put this in context, about $240 billion in total investment in 2012. About $44 billion of it was in the United States. The inevitable question about this chart is what happened in 2011 when we saw things go all the way up to $65 billion. And the short answer is the U.S. stimulus package had a lot to do with what happened there. The U.S. government, by our count, put about $68 billion into the stimulus, specifically targeted at clean energy. Some use a little different number. You count high-speed rail, things like that. But it was about $68 billion by our count. And that's taken about 3 years to get out the door, although most of it's out now. 2011 saw some major projects get loan guarantees from the U.S. federal government, and that accounts for a big chunk of the bump. The other thing, though, that took place in 2011 is that there was a a real rush to finance wind projects that sought to get built by the end of 2012 because of the anticipated end of the production tax credit from the federal government. So where does that put us in terms of total capacity? You can see we added about 17 gigawatts of new capacity in 2012. We went from about 43.5 gigawatts to 85.7 gigawatts. By the way, this does include large hydro in the total here, and that represents a doubling. And that's the one and only little bit of animation I'll put you through today, which is that the president basically made this guy pretty happy because that was the one, you know, one of his key promises when he ran for president was that he was going to double clean energy capacity in the United States. And I would say that more or less that, you know, he can boast was accomplished. In terms of where, you know, on a percentage basis, though, in terms of where renewables and these other technologies fill in, we had a very interesting year last year with coal usage dropping very sharply, in part because of the growth of renewables, but really even more so, or equally so, I should say, because of the growth in natural gas usage. Last year, in addition to a number of things that happened last year, we had a very warm winter, and natural gas prices at one point dropped all the way down to $2 per million BTU. To put that in context, they were $11 or $12 at one point, you know, several years ago, and they're about $4, you know, now. So that kind of decline meant that a lot of operators chose to purchase gas-powered fuel rather than coal, and that drove down the coal numbers. An interesting, hopefully positive sidebar from all of this is that U.S. emissions are also down substantially in the last several years as a result of this. Again, even sort of bigger picture look at the U.S. energy situation, which at least I find interesting, is that if you roll the clock back a couple of years, as the recession took hold in about 2008, you can see that U.S. energy demand dropped. That makes sense, right? So the economy slowed down, a lot of manufacturing slowed down, and the demand for electricity and energy overall declined. But what's been one of the more interesting things and positive developments in the last couple of years is that as GDP has come back, as the economy has slowly been limping back to life, actually energy use has also continued to go down. As you can see, that orange line essentially points in a different direction from the actual demand for electricity, for energy. And this is certainly a positive sign in terms of CO2 emissions, but it's also a positive sign in terms of companies becoming more efficient in how they use energy. And I don't kid myself into thinking that they're doing that for environmental reasons. I think there's a lot of cost savings that's gone on and a lot of recognition from a lot of big players that they can be more efficient in how they use energy. But it's also been consumers and the fact that automobile standards are rising and the requirements on each of us to buy, or sorry, on automakers to provide vehicles that have higher efficiency are starting to actually have a positive impact. So I would be remiss if I didn't talk just a little bit more about gas. And in particular, you know, the question of gas versus renewables. Gas, as you know, has about 50% the CO2 emissions from generation that coal does. And so there's a great deal of talk of gas being a quote-unquote bridge fuel to address the issue of climate change. Putting that issue aside, you know, one of the questions that we often get asked is, well, can you build, you know, are wind projects, is renewables going to be viable in the long term if we have gas prices that are really low? And indeed, gas prices were as low as $2 per million BTU last year, and as of yesterday, they were about $4 per million BTU. And we would make the case that gas prices at their current levels are probably not sustainable for the long run. And the main reason is it simply costs more to extract the gas from some of the major gas plays in the United States than the cost than the price of gas right now. So in other words, if you look at this chart, the dotted line shows you where the Henry Hub price for natural gas was at about $4 yesterday. And then the extraction costs of getting gas out of the ground in the Marcellus, Haynesville, and Barnett shales, which are all above that. for a variety of reasons, they're producing right now because they can sell what are called liquid, you know, the liquid fuels that come off those plays. But in the long run, our view is gas prices have to rise. And when gas prices rise, they'll probably help pull up electricity prices, and they will also make wind projects and solar projects, for that matter, more cost competitive. So in other words, part of the goal on the renewable side is to drive down their costs, but you also, and they've been fighting somewhat of a difficult battle because at the same time that the industry's been driving down costs, gas prices have been coming down and driving down gas-generated electricity costs as well. If one goes up and the other keeps going down, renewables become more competitive. And this is just a picture of some flaring going. Again, this is just a quick look at how that's kind of played out over the last several years. One of the things that we do is we track power purchase agreements via filings from the FERC in Washington. These are the contracts between the producers and the buyers of electricity. These are just to look at wind prices. And the orange line, without getting into great detail, just details the contracts that we've seen ranging all the way up to in the neighborhood of about $80 per megawatt hour for solar in 2011, and then dipping. And again, these are just new contracts signed for wind, and how that compares with the actual electricity prices. And without getting into the detail, all the squiggly lines, basically, those squiggly lines represent the decline in electricity prices that has taken place post-recession and due to also in part to the natural gas boom. And you can see that in a number of cases, there have been PPAs signed for wind above the existing wholesale power price for electricity. And then just a couple more slides and then I'll take questions. I'm not going to talk in great detail about Minnesota, simply I'm no expert on the specifics of the state, but one thing I would point out is that that in the last couple of years we've seen, and particularly last year, we saw this extraordinary build-out of new wind capacity across the United States. There was about 13,600 megawatts of new wind added in 2012 in the U.S. That blew away a record of about 10,000 megawatts that had been in existence before. And I think one of the things that these I find exciting about some of that build-out was that a lot of it was driven not necessarily because of state renewable portfolio standards. So, for instance, about 2.5 gigawatts or 2,500 megawatts of new wind was installed in Kansas and Oklahoma. Those are two states that don't have binding requirements for the utilities to add wind. And that capacity was added because those are winded places where they can produce power from wind really quite cheaply. And we've seen some power purchase agreements signed as low as even $30 or $40 per megawatt hour in the United States. So wind is becoming more economically competitive, but it also has implications for renewable portfolio standards. This is just a very, the dotted line here just looks at wind generation in the region, in the Midwest region, and then totals up the RPS or state level requirements. And you can see that basically there's more wind online than the combined RPS requirements in the region. And this is in part because, like I said, of the real build out that we saw last year, which was driven by economics, was also driven by the fact that everybody was terrified that the U.S. production tax credit was going to expire at the end of 2012. And technically speaking, it did. And then Congress renewed it on January 1st, 2013. But what it created is this massive scramble and this backload, or the sort of front-loading of projects into calendar year 2012. And the unfortunate thing for the industry is that it means that in 2013, we're going to actually see very little new projects actually built. And again, this is probably the closest I'll get to talking about Minnesota. This is just a look at from our analysis of power purchase agreements. And I just, it's a look at the average purchase price of off-takers for projects, all clean energy projects, just through the end, through the first half of 2012. And I only provide just a little bit of context that you look at the prices that are being paid for clean energy by the New England and Southern California Edison, you see prices around averaging around $100, $107 per megawatt hour. But if you go down the stack, you can see Minnesota Power all the way down at about $35 per megawatt hour. So in other words, it's cheaper here for wind, a lot cheaper here for wind than it has been in other parts of the United States. So, let me just make sure I've got just one last one here. This one last chart here is about solar. We don't have nearly as much data in the United States about large-scale solar projects as we do for wind. There simply haven't been as many, and there's also a challenge in that the federal government, these FERC filings come a little bit late. You need to have a year or two, I think about a year of operation before you can get your hands on the data. This kind of, I think, hopefully shows that we've also seen a real decline in the pricing around solar projects over the last several years, from roughly $200, you can see back in July 2008, or a little less than that, for that big purple bubble for the Sempra project out west, down to well under to about $75 for some of the California RFP projects that we're seeing as well. We've even seen lower more recently in New Mexico. I would note, I think if you look at these, just about all of these are out west or in the southwest. And when you have the kind of solar resource that they have out there that generates the kind of capacity factors that they do out there, the project developer can afford to sign lower price power purchase agreements. In other words, this is not what one would, I would suggest, benchmarking for a Minnesota solar project. But I do just provide it as some suggested an indication that all that data I showed you earlier about the module prices coming down, about the CapEx prices coming down, that is filtering through into the kinds of contracts that are being offered for actual buyers of solar power. So with that, I guess I'm just happy to take whatever questions there may be about all that.
Thank you. We have a few. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was intrigued by slide 13 and 24. Are you familiar with the Annual Energy Outlook 2013 report by the EIA? It's quite similar to your slide 24. Combining those two together, it looks as if solar went from being somewhat obscenely expensive to just being, in your report and in this one, being very expensive, 2.5 times wind, about 3 times the natural gas. Looking at the regionalized, do you agree with the EIA preliminary report that regionalized PV in Minnesota, well, in this region, would be 2.5 to 3 times what natural gas and wind, because Minnesota region-wise is optimal for wind, and then less optimal than California for solar efficiency.
Mr. Zindler.
I just want to clarify, are you saying the AEO said that Minnesota solar was 2.5 times the cost of wind?
Representative Palm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at both your slide 24 and the annual energy outlook for overview of levelized new generation and looking out to the 2018 and et cetera, both of them point to about a 2.5 to 3 when I look at the information. Is that approximately the magnitude for PV?
Mr. Zindler.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say that I haven't done the calculation specific to Minnesota by any means. I would say that, and certainly, in best-in-class solar projects like the ones in the Southwest, they're giving, in some cases, already giving gas a run for the money. But your point about if you look at it on this kind of a basis, on an unsubsidized basis, could solar be more expensive? Certainly. I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I would say this, though, that, when you take into account, there's obviously a lot of things to take into account when you consider the costs involved in generation from different types of technologies. And the one thing I would say about what we call this LCOE analysis that we do, and we do it every quarter, and it is the benchmark for the energy industry, but it is to some degree fundamentally unfair to renewables, because the one thing about this that this chart can't tell you is what the cost of natural gas is going to be 10 years from now. But the one thing I can tell you right now is that the marginal cost of offering a solar project 10 years from now will be pretty much close to zero. In other words, you don't have to pay for the sun and you don't have to pay for the wind, right? So the one thing is the variability that's inherent in natural gas prices, which have done this, can't get effectively baked into this kind of analysis. So it's the one thing to kind of keep in mind is that when you build a renewable energy project, yes, you spend a lot of money up front potentially, right? But then you know what your marginal operating costs are over the lifetime of the project. You've eliminated the volatility and the uncertainty that comes with building a coal plant or a gas plant. So that is the one thing that I would say that always makes this a challenge on the kind of apples-to-apples analysis. But I think your point that is solar often more expensive than natural gas in many parts of the U.S., certainly, no question about that.
Follow-up, Representative Palm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And touching on that, because what we're looking at is a snapshot of when we should jump into promoting the solar, when is the right time, and since this is like a five-year outlook that the EIA did and a range that do you have an idea of when there would be, it'd be less than double, it'd be close for, because you do a min and a max, so you do take solar efficiencies, and it efficiency southwest versus here, so you would have some idea, because, you know, again.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. I mean, I can't speak specifically to Minnesota or even the Midwest, but what we're, and it's a complex question because there's central power generation and then there's retail power generation. So if I have a system up on my roof, right, the only question is that the math that I need to do is offsetting the retail rate of electricity that I pay, which is different than the wholesale price of electricity. All which is to say that we've already seen, there are some markets around the world right now, and granted they're few and far between in the United States, but where it already economically makes more sense to do a solar system on a residential system than it does to be buying the electricity. So if you live in a very sunny place, or you live in a place with very expensive retail electricity, it could already make sense for you to be doing solar right now. And that's clearly markets like Hawaii, but it's also markets in Europe where they have very expensive power prices where it's not even that sunny. So it's a difficult question for me to answer other than to say that, you know, we anticipate more and more markets are going to reach so-called grid parity over the next 5 years, and a number of them will be in the United States. I can't, unfortunately, don't know off the top of my head, you know, we haven't run the numbers on what the cost of power is, retail cost of power is for Minnesota, and factored that through, but something we'd certainly be happy to look into.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I guess my question was on the same slide, number 24, regarding the levelized cost, and I was wondering if you took into account some of the newer solar panels who claim to have a long life. I mean, they might be 10, 20, they might be 100 years lifespan of a solar panel, whereas when you look at natural gas or coal, you have to continually buy the fuel. Have you looked at the long term, maybe even out 50 years, to levelize that cost if the panels remain intact the same?
The short answer is that this is based on a 20-year analysis, and it's based on basically bog standard, highly commoditized common modules that are in the marketplace today with the typical capacity factor. There are clearly some fascinating and exciting new technologies being developed, and we anticipate that the capacity factors will rise, but this is based on existing technology right now. But it's certainly an interesting question, and like I said, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that I think differentiates solar from and wind, for that matter, and geothermal, is that you know what your marginal costs are 10 years from now, pretty much. They're close to zero, and we simply can't know what a gas or a coal price will be 10 years from now.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, let me compliment you on inviting the Testament of Fire in. This is a great testimony, and I'm going to resist the urge to make a joke about your boss banning large containers of hop in New York City, or the owner, the namesake for Bloomberg. So just a couple of questions. First of all, in the area of incentives, In the area of incentives, there tends to be production incentives versus installation incentives. Both of them have their trade-offs in terms of incentivizing capacity or incentivizing production. Worldwide, where is the gravitation, where is the movement towards that, or is it a hybrid of both?
Mr. Zindler.
Thank you, and Madam Chair. Interesting question. You know, in Europe, some of the hardest lessons learned have been around these feed-in tariffs, which simply pay a flat, you know, a certain rate based on, you know, that's set by policymakers. And obviously, those are production-based. The more you produce, the more, you know, subsidy has to get paid out. And in the U.S., we've had, we've had 30% U.S. federal investment tax credit, which is based on the CapEx of the project. I guess, you know, my view is that you want to create a policy which incentivizes the best, you know, the best kinds of projects and that are the most productive. And so you want to sort of give them a, you want to give them a bone for putting out projects that have the highest rate of generation. I also think, though, you want to provide a system whereby you give market participants an incentive to come in with the lowest prices. So one of the interesting developments we've seen in the last couple of years has been greater interest in what are called reverse auctions, where you simply tell the market, you know, we want to build 100 megawatts of whatever wind, let's say, and you invite the private market to come forth and bid. And whoever comes in with the lowest bid, you know, gets, you know, up to 100 megawatts, they get the contract. It's not a foolproof system by any means, and you know, one of the markets that I look after is Brazil, and they've been very aggressive about doing this kind of stuff, and you can have participants who bid in at rates that are unrealistically low, and then they can't fulfill their promise and actually build the project. But there is something to be said for so-called price discovery, because I mean everything I just showed that this is a highly dynamic market where prices have been moving extremely quickly over the last 3 or 4 years. So there's something to be said about giving the market the opportunity to sort out what that price should be, as opposed to trying to sort of ascertain it yourself. One other sort of thought, and while I'm sort of, you know, floating policy ideas, is the other thing is that you can take a third-party source that gathers information about what the sort of appropriate price is of solar or wind or whatever, based on market conditions or whatever factor you want, and have that be something that sets the price. To my mind is that third party or whatever that data is, it has to be transparent, and the market has to understand when those changes are coming. Because one of the problems we've seen in Europe is that that a number of developers have been surprised, essentially, when there have been changes, even in some cases retroactive changes to subsidies, that have really sort of pulled the rug out from under the industry. So I don't know if that quite answers your question, or maybe more than answers your question.
Representative Grappa.
Well, Madam Chair, to the testifier, I mean, I think what you're basically, I was looking to find out if there was a direction where we're seeing the environment move towards. The reality is, I mean, the short answer is it depends. I mean, sometimes people are doing incentives on production, others are doing that. Do you have an example? You mentioned this reverse auction. Mm-hmm. Do you have a couple markets you could suggest to legislators to study up to see successes and failures of that in place?
Brazil's certainly one case, and I'm happy to forward to the, we've written a lot about this. I'm happy to forward to the committee some of the research we've written about Brazil, and I know California has also started to experiment with this as well. And there's some others that are starting to happen in Europe as well, in part to try to really make sure that you align your subsidy with where the market is at a given moment in time.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Grappa.
I have two more questions, that's okay? All right, thanks. The next question is that obviously there's divergent marketplaces with varying rules on how energy is priced. So just because, you know, peak power tends to be used, you know, 6 p.m., 7 p.m., hot summer day, that's when people are paying the most for electricity. But in their bills, when they're paying, they just get a flat rate. Everything gets averaged out. Is there a worldwide or in the United States, is there a movement towards one sort of pricing system over another where people are actually, you know, on one end it would be you're going to pay for what the charge of that kilowatt is at this exact moment. The flip side to it is it doesn't really matter time of year, time of day. Everything's just going to get averaged out, because obviously that policy can have dramatic impacts on the use of, for example, solar.
The short answer is I don't think there's been nearly as much sophisticated kind of pricing schemes put in place. I mean, the concept of variable pricing is something that seems to be taking place more and more, whether it's how you buy your plane ticket or go on StubHub and buy some basketball tickets or whatever it is. You know, thanks to the internet and all this technology, we can be much more dynamic in understanding supply and demand, and more or less very little of that has come through into electricity consumption so far. But it's certainly an intriguing idea. I think if consumers had a better understanding of how much more expensive it is at certain types of times of the day to run their dishwasher, they might dictate. I mean, I set my dishwasher on a 4-hour delay to run at 1 a.m, but that's only because I work I'm a nerd in the energy industry, right?
Yeah.
Most consumers don't have that level of transparency. I think there have been some cases where that's taken place in Europe, but not as many. And I think it's a clever idea, frankly.
Representative Grappa.
Thank you. And then my final question, and thank you for the comments about the there's some new terms here I'll try to use in my vocabulary to give the impression that I'm smarter than I am. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely true about variable pricing with its impacts. And I'm wondering if there's any, if you don't have to answer this now, but if there's any way you could share with us if there's any markets where they've been moving forward on this and they've seen successes. Anecdotally, we've been reported in the Minnesota market that people say, once people just know what they're using, when they see data in front of them, that they become 30% to 50% more efficient just because they're aware of it.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, from a pricing standpoint, it seems like that's an area where the left and the right could actually agree with things, where we're using markets to drive prices down. And
well, it's a very good point. I mean, one of the, Madam Chair,
that
the,
wasn't my question,
the
by the way,
yeah, sorry, but I mean, one of the things. I don't know about 30% or 50%, but there has been these companies like Opower and others that try to give consumers just a transparency, greater transparency on what electricity they're using at any given time without having variable pricing even involved, as you point out. There has been some studies that have shown that that's made a bit of a difference in consumer behavior. I guess I'm of the view that unless you really change consumers really have to have a strong financial incentive to change behavior. And actually, you know, for all the concerns and complaining we hear about prices of energy in the United States, we pay very little for electricity in the U.S. compared to what they pay in Europe and a lot of other parts of the world. And inevitably, that makes them much more price conscious just to begin with.
Okay, so Madam Chair, my final question. Thank you. Is when this, there's different viewpoints in the legislature on subsidies and government involvement in certain types of production. At the beginning of the session, a lot of people hailed Germany, and they talked about that. And then as session went on, the opponents of subsidies, every time there's a news article on Germany, would kind of pass around on the desks here. Just from a forecasting model, where do you personally, or where does Bloomberg see the German model going in the short term and intermediate term? There's a lot of divergent information coming out of that market right now about what's taking place, and we're hearing it's great. We're hearing that they're on the cusp of disaster, and she's going to lose her re-election this fall. Where from a purely just dollars and cents forecasting, where does Bloomberg see the German market going with regards to this? And thank you again for your testimony.
Sure, and Madam Chair, I interesting question. I mean, listen, on the one hand, I would argue that all of us who are interested in putting solar systems on a roof owe Germany a big debt of gratitude, because effectively what they did was they subsidized solar globally in such a generous way that it prompted a whole lot of interesting things to take place around the world, in particular China, to scale up. And as we saw this big scale up, that has helped to drive the cost way down. And so, frankly, you know, the U.S. is kind of a second or last mover in terms of policy support for solar compared to Germany or in Italy, but stands to benefit from that because the costs have now come down thanks to what Germany has done. So, I mean, And in theory, in the grander scheme of things, in terms of solar now becoming much more economically viable in the developing world for those who just literally want to buy a tiny solar lantern, which they can now do for, you know, $20 or $30 and bring light to a hut. This is a rich country, Germany, that has helped to subsidize solar and make it available for poorer countries. To my mind, that's a good thing. Now, in terms of where Germany goes from here, you know, I think we have seen the tariffs, get scaled back. They are also reaching an interesting inflection point where PV is reaching a very substantial amount of the actual capacity online, and posing interesting challenges for managing the grid over there. I'll show you one of the slides. We basically are expecting the solar market for Germany to very much slow down in the next couple of years for those reasons.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While on the subject of Germany, I'm just wondering, because I've read some of these same articles that Representative Garofalo has mentioned, and there seems to be this problem with, particularly it sounds like in Bavaria, where everybody has a solar panel on their house, and it's causing problems within the grid. But my question is, in Germany, since they've been at this a little bit longer, are the people that are putting these solar panels on their homes, are they paying anything for the connectivity to the grid? I know they're, you know, basically if you can't afford or don't want to put a solar panel on your house, or you live in an apartment building, they're not putting one on, whatever the case may be, you're paying through your rates for being on the grid, you're paying for those other people to be able to connect to the grid and have free energy. So I see that as a problem coming down the line, where, you know, in decades to follow, when the infrastructure has to be updated because it's getting old, to me, you just can't connect to the grid and be making money off of that for free for forever.
Mr. Zindler.
Well, one of the complaints has been exactly that. Those who didn't put the systems on their roof, they argue now are paying, you know, they're helping to subsidize those who have. And, you know, I don't think there's, it's kind of hard to, I wouldn't debate that. One thing I will say is that, you know, for the cost of these feed-in tariffs over the long run, and the liability that it's incurred. On the other hand, Germany, you know, is dramatically reduced its reliance on natural gas imported from, you know, abroad. And so, you know, some of the kinds of benefits that you enjoy, so, you know, all the costs of, again, as the same point I was trying to make earlier, all the costs for renewables come up front, but the benefits take 10, 20 years to play out. So, you know, whatever benefits they'll enjoy by not having to import as much, I think we're going to see over time. But I guess I wouldn't necessarily debate the issue of whether, you know, whether this was equitable or not. I guess I wouldn't try to debate.
One other question. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My other question is, what do you see coming down the line in terms of research for storage of energy? Because to me, that is really one of the secrets of making renewables really viable, is how do you store that energy, because of the fact that, you know, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow, and those intermittent problems.
It's interesting. Interesting question. Thanks. None of the slides I showed today, but we have a whole group that just looks at what we call energy smart technologies, including power storage technologies. And there have been there's been some advances, but I would say I wouldn't call them major ones to date in this area. But one of the sort of interesting, without getting too much sidetracked, one of the interesting side stories that I think has a potential impact eventually for solar is that over the last couple of years, the automakers have focused very much on electric vehicles. And frankly, they built out a lot more manufacturing capacity for lithium-ion batteries than has been required. In other words, the capacity demand imbalance that we're seeing in solar is actually very much present in lithium-ion batteries as well. These battery manufacturing plants basically were built with the goal towards outfitting GM Volts and Leafs and things like that, and they haven't sold as well as the automakers had expected. So as a result, we have a lot of extra capacity on for lithium ion. And so even though lithium ion batteries, and really for the most part, aren't necessarily the best technology for grid scale power storage, we are expecting to see more and more of them used in that manner because the prices are going to come down, have been coming down very rapidly for lithium ion batteries. So that's one area I would just suggest to keep an eye on so far. But the short answer is that it hasn't been massive grid scale power storage has not been rolled out in a big way in any country yet. And I would argue that most countries, it's not frankly immediately a relevant issue right now, but will be as solar grows. I mean, you talk about a country where you have a level of market penetration of solar of, I don't know what it is, but probably under 1% in the United States, it's not as big an issue. Germany, starting to become more of an issue.
Other questions from members? Senators have been very quiet. Any questions from senators? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, yes, I want to take a minute to thank the witness for flying out here and spending the day with us. This is extremely helpful. I think that's what we were looking for, just factual information and from financial perspective. So I want to just say that we're very appreciative of you coming out here, and I think as your comments near the end point out, I mean, so much is in flux and will continue to be in flux, and getting your perspective on where things are, I think I'll say on behalf of both the House and Senate and Democrats and Republicans, it's helpful.
Well, just for my part, it's been an honor, and thank you very much. I mean, I think one of the things we hope to try and do is bring as much sort of real-world market information to these discussions as possible. Certainly, as a taxpayer, I have every interest in wanting to see smart policies made, but also as somebody who actually would like to see the industry successful in the long run, I think policies that provide support for it in a reasonable level are very important to its long-term benefit. So thank you for this opportunity.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Zindler, if you have any follow-up information that from the comments, if you think would be helpful, if you just get it to our offices, we'll get it to the
sure.
members.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for coming, and thank you, members. We're adjourned.